KBOO Community Radio and Chamber Music Northwest have been working together for over 40 years to bring diverse music to the community and to underserved populations, and we are working together in the Give Guide. There are opportunities for tickets to Christian Tetzloff's performance of Bach's solo violin works and other thank you gifts. More information is available at kboo.fm/cmnw2017.
Chamber Music Northwest and KBOO present Bach's Complete Solo Violin Works with Christian Tetzloff on Saturday, December 16th at 6:30 p.m. at the Agnes Flanagan Chapel at Lewis and Clark College in Portland. Tetzloff is a Hamburg-based violin player who is known as a performer who explores the limits of feelings and musical expression through the violin. This performance of Bach's masterpieces will feature the equivalent of two concerts with an extra-long intermission. Again, that's Bach's Complete Solo Violin Works with Christian Tetzloff on Saturday, December 16th at 6:30 p.m. at the Agnes Flanagan Chapel at Lewis and Clark College, 0615 Southwest Palatine Hill Road in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
All right, the time is 6:04 and you're listening to KBOO Portland. If you've tuned in to listen to Preference, we're experiencing some technical difficulties, so for now, here's an episode of this week's This Way Out.
I'm here at the Supreme Court today because I respectfully declined to create a custom cake that would celebrate a view of marriage in direct conflict with my faith's core teachings.
When I hire a baker, I'm not hiring them to give their speech. I'm hiring them so that my speech can be expressed.
This has never been about a cake. This is about freedom for LGBT people to live full lives in public and not in constant fear that they will be denied basic service just for who they are.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Austria's top court declares civil marriage equality. A Tanzanian lesbian is arrested after her videoed romance goes viral. And the U.S. Supreme Court considers free speech, creativity, and anti-queer bias. Those stories and more this week now that you've tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Carol Myers.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending December 9th, 2017. Austria's constitutional court has opened civil marriage to same-gender couples and opened civil partnerships to heterosexual couples who prefer that status to marriage. The nation's highest court removed the heterosexuals-only language of marriage laws in its December 4th decision, ruling that restricting same-gender couples to less-than-equal civil partnerships, which had been available to them since 2010, was discriminatory. However, the court said its ruling would not come into effect until January 1st, 2019, unless the country's incoming new administration decides to open marriage to lesbian and gay couples sooner than that. According to Pink News, since it will likely be a coalition government of the right-wing Austrian People's Party and the hard-right Freedom Party, that's not likely to happen. The justices did specify that the plaintiff couples directly involved in the constitutional court case could marry sooner than January 2019, unless other obstacles speak against it. Austria joins recent European marriage equality converts Finland, Malta, and Germany. Weddings began in those three countries this year.
The head of Cambodia's Human Rights Committee was one of the prominent speakers at the 7th International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Trans, and Intersex Association Asia Conference, held December 4th through 8th in Phnom Penh. Kio Remney encouraged attendees to continue pressuring the Cambodian government to end discrimination and extend legal recognition, but in a slow and respectful way. Even though there are no laws against private consensual adult same-gender sex in Cambodia, social stigma is still widespread. We may take some time to educate the people in the community, he said. More than 300 people took part in the conference under the theme United for Love, including activists from some 30 countries, development partners, organizations, diplomatic representatives, and local officials. A movement for marriage equality in the Southeast Asian country has been growing. But there's been pushback by Prime Minister Hun Sen, who started to crack down on political opposition, independent media, and human rights groups, including the NGO Cambodian Center for Human Rights, which has expressed strong support for LGBT equality in recent years. Sen claims that it's a discredited organization that was created by foreigners.
The marriage equality movement is also growing in Japan. As the Kyoto News Service noted, six local governments recognize same-gender couples and treat them the same as married heterosexuals, although their unions are not legally recognized for purposes of public housing, visiting a partner in the hospital, or inheriting property, because a same-gender partner is not considered to be a family member under federal law. The national government continues to resist moves to change the marriage statutes, while several cell phone operators, life insurers, and hospitals have started to recognize same-gender couples as families. The city of Osaka also officially recognized two men as foster parents earlier this year. Recent remarks by senior lawmaker Wataru Takeshita of the ruling Liberal Democratic Party that same-gender partners of state guests should not be invited to banquets hosted by Emperor Akihito and Empress Michiko because it doesn't fit with Japan's tradition drew strong criticism from many quarters. Mr. Takeshita may not be able to assume that there are LGBTs in Japan, said openly gay law professor and activist Ken Suzuki. He may not be able to assume it is possible that a Japanese prime minister may bring a same-sex partner to a banquet someday. Takeshita later apologized.
A woman in Tanzania has learned the hard way that being video recorded on a friend's cell phone is not always a good idea. The unnamed woman, said to be a worker at the local gold mine and between 30 and 40 years of age, was arrested in the northwestern town of Giata after a video of her allegedly hugging, kissing, and presenting another woman with a ring went viral. Regional Commissioner Robert Gabriel told reporters that the country's laws are clear as homosexuality is not allowed, and we will ensure that the law takes its course. It's believed that police are still searching for the woman who appeared in the video accepting the ring. Carnal knowledge of any person against the order of nature is illegal in the East African country, and convictions carry a sentence of up to life in prison. Since he took power in 2015, President John Magufuli has started to rival the leaders of neighboring Uganda and Kenya with escalating crackdowns on sexual minorities. 13 people were arrested in October at a hotel HIV/AIDS prevention workshop, and Tanzania's health minister banned the sale of lube in 2016 to supposedly discourage men from having sex with men. This week's arrest of the videotaped woman is thought to be the first in the country for alleged lesbian activity.
The Trump administration is being dragged, kicking and screaming, to court-ordered acceptance of qualified transgender military service members on January 1st. U.S. District Judge Colleen Collar Cotelli demanded last week that the Pentagon begin accepting transgender recruits on that date, rather than waiting until March for the results of yet another study of the impact of trans troops on enlistees ordered earlier this year by Defense Secretary James Mattis. The Justice Department filed a motion for an emergency stay of that order late this week and asked for an immediate ruling. The Trump administration is trying to reverse yet another progressive policy of the Obama administration, which had approved opening military service to qualified transgender troops in July of this year, before that was scuttled by Trump's infamous tweets. At least four federal lawsuits challenging Trump's proposed trans ban have been filed. A second district court last week echoed Collar Cotelli's original October decision that the transgender plaintiffs are likely to win on constitutional grounds. Meanwhile, the Pentagon has confirmed that it is now taking steps to prepare for the court-ordered January 1st deadline. It's unclear how many trans people will actually sign up, however, considering the still unresolved legal issues that cloud their possible military careers.
In other news, one half of one of the gay couples who were infamously denied marriage licenses by Kentucky clerk Kim Davis returned to the Rowan County Courthouse this week. But this time, David Ermold was there to file papers to run against Davis. She announced her re-election campaign last week. It will be the first time she'll face the voters since refusing to issue marriage licenses to same-gender couples 2 years ago, for which she spent a few days in jail for contempt of court, only to emerge as a martyred darling of the religious right. Changes in state law eventually allowed her to keep her job and not have to personally sign the marriage licenses of same-gender couples. The 43-year-old Ermald is an English professor at the University of Pikeville and director of Moorhead Pride. He won't be the only challenger to Kim Davis, but he'll probably be the only one raising the incumbent's homophobia. But he rejected what he called the divide-and-conquer style of politicking. "This campaign we are putting together," he said, "is about unity and bringing people together and restoring fairness." The Associated Press reported that Ermald's candidacy has already attracted some national attention. Comedian and actor Patton Oswalt sent Ermald a tweet asking, "Anything I can do to help?"
And finally, a lopsided majority in Australia's House, as expected, passed legislation to open civil marriage to same-gender couples on December 7th, without any crippling amendments. 4 MPs went on record as opposed, while 10 MPs stayed out of the chamber and abstained from voting altogether, including former Prime Minister Tony Abbott, who ignored his constituents' nearly 4-1 vote for marriage equality in the national postal plebiscite that concluded in mid-November. The House action came on the heels of overwhelming passage of a companion bill in the Senate on November 29th. The measure was officially signed into law on December 8th by Governor General Peter Cosgrove on behalf of Queen Elizabeth II, Australia's constitutional head of state. Because the country's marriage laws require a 30-day waiting period after any couple declares its intention to wed, lesbian and gay couples will have to wait until January 9th to start walking down the aisle. However, the new law immediately recognizes the marriages of Australian same-gender couples who've legally wed in other countries. Here's what one of Australia's proudest moments sounded like.
"As there are fewer than 5 members on the side for the noes in this division, I declare the question resolved in the affirmative in accordance with Standing Order 127. The names of those members who are in the minority will be recorded in the votes and proceedings." The clerk.
Third reading, a bill for an act to amend the law relating to the definition of marriage and protect religious freedoms and for related purposes.
That's it.
People in the House gallery spontaneously celebrated in song with what some Aussies would prefer to be their national anthem.
NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending December 9th, 2017. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Carol Myers.
The U.S. Supreme Court on December 11th refused to hear a Georgia lesbian's job discrimination case to determine whether or not LGBT people are covered under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which bans bias based on sex. Several other Title VII cases are being considered by federal courts across the country.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis.
I'm Margaret Cho.
This is Edmund White.
Hi, I'm Kate Quinton.
Hello, I'm Armistead Maupin.
I'm Clive Barker.
Hello, this is Ian McKellen.
I'm Stephen Fry.
I'm Harvey Milk.
Hi, this is Janice Ian.
This is Essex Hemphill.
I'm Ellen DeGeneres.
I'm Tab Hunter.
This is Bishop Gene Robinson.
I'm Robbie Kaplan.
I'm Barney Frank.
I'm Cleve Jones.
My name is Kate Kendall.
I'm Dan Savage.
Hi, I'm Daryl Stevens, and you've discovered
This Way Out.
This Way Out.
This Way Out.
The international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities.
How dare they?
And those who love them.
There's been a lot of noise in the air this year. You might even call it sound and fury. You can help defeat the noise by joining This Way Out's year-end campaign at thiswayout.org.
Yes. I knew you were coming, I'd have baked a cake. How'd you do? How'd you do? How'd you do?
The questions were whose free speech and discrimination against whom when a politically divided U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments on December 5th in a case about much more than just cake. If Amir Confection were the point, the case of the Colorado baker and the gay couple looking for a wedding cake would not have such enormous implications for LGBT civil rights. Is it about art? Swing vote Justice Anthony Kennedy was skeptical when it came to the argument that the baker, who considers himself to be an artist, could not be forced to create messages with which that artist disagrees. On the other hand, Justice Kennedy also did not seem to believe that the Colorado Civil Rights Commission displayed tolerance or respect for the baker's religious beliefs when it found that his refusal to make the couple's cake violated the state's non-discrimination law. On the steps of the Supreme Court, Baker Jack Phillips was emotional about what he called the favorite part of his job.
Designing a custom cake and creating them allow me to use my artistic vision to create works of art that are beautiful and distinctive and that mark the beginning of something sacred. I'm here at the Supreme Court today because I respectfully declined to create a custom cake that would celebrate a view of marriage in direct conflict with my faith's core teachings on marriage.
Customer David Mullins and his husband Charlie Craig were just as emotional about the mortification and humiliation the incident caused them. Mullins said it's not about cake to them.
This has never been about a cake. And this isn't about weddings. It has never been about weddings. No, this is about freedom. Freedom for LGBT people to live full lives in public and not in constant fear that they will be denied basic service in businesses, fired from their jobs, or lose their homes just for who they are. When people live in a world where they can legally be turned away, they feel rejected. They feel unsafe.
Public News Service reporter Eric Galatas has more from Denver.
Colorado law prohibits businesses like Masterpiece from discriminating based on a range of characteristics, including race, sex, nationality, religion, and sexual orientation. Craig Conneth, an associate professor at the University of Colorado Law School, says the court's decision could have broad implications for anti-discrimination laws in Colorado and across the nation.
What this law and laws like it do, they're basically trying to address that history of discrimination and protect LGBT individuals in a range of areas. So if they want to go to the doctor, a grocery store, or a restaurant, this law prevents them from being kicked out.
Phillips' lawyer claims that Baker is an artist and should not be forced to express what the government dictates. An amicus brief filed on behalf of 20 states and a brief from the U.S. Justice Department make similar arguments. Conneth disagrees and says a cake ordered at a bakery serving the general public does not represent the expression of the shop owner.
When I hire a baker, when I hire someone to make a billboard, I'm not hiring them to give their speech. I'm hiring them so that my speech can be expressed. So I think that they're wrong in saying that this is the baker's speech as opposed to this being the couple's speech.
In the Colorado Court of Appeals 2015 ruling, justices cited a 1964 challenge to the Civil Rights Act where a court ruled that a business owner could not refuse to serve black people based on religious beliefs. Justices said Phillips could voice his opposition to gay marriage on a sign or on the store's website, but picking and choosing customers based on their sexual orientation was against Colorado law. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Galatas.
Andy Hum and Ann Northrup of Gay USA TV took apart the proceedings and the players.
Four of the justices, Alito, Thomas, Roberts, and Gorsuch, were appallingly, you know, with the baker on this. I mean, Alito was saying, well, you're being forced to write something. No, he's not being forced to write something. It's how he, you know, he's making roses on a cake, okay? That's what he does for everybody.
And the four liberal justices, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, Kagan, and Breyer, were clearly on the side of the same-sex couple and their right not to be discriminated against and to be treated equally with everyone else in the public realm.
So we might as well have just made it a colloquy and had the case heard by Anthony Kennedy.
He is the linchpin at the moment. You can predict any kind of outcome based on what Anthony Kennedy said.
He seemed to have a couple of deep concerns, one of which was the what he felt was anti-religious animus, hostility of one of the commissioners on the Civil Rights Commission.
In considering this case, she said she was tired of religion being used to excuse discrimination and ill treatment of stigmatized people, and that she found this despicable.
She said, look, the Holocaust, slavery, were done in the name of religion. And she said, that's despicable.
So Anthony Kennedy turns this around to claim that she is calling religion despicable. And really what she's saying is that religion is being misused
right.
in horrible ways by people who are manipulating these situations and inappropriately claiming a religious view to promote things like the Holocaust or slavery.
He's torn. He is a very conservative justice who has written all four major gay rights decisions in our favor, okay? But he has also signed on to the Hobby Lobby decision, which
I think is crucial in this case.
Right, which absolutely allowed a private business to invoke its religion and not give coverage for contraception. Kennedy asked the Solicitor General of the United States, representing our government now under the Trump administration,
which has switched sides in this case,
can the bakery put up a sign that says, no wedding cakes for gay couples? And he said it could say yes, and it could, as long as it said no custom cakes.
And then Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked at the White House press briefing shortly after these arguments, does the president agree, since his solicitor general said this, that businesses should be allowed to post signs saying no custom wedding cakes for gay people?
The lawyer from the Solicitor General's Office for the Administration said today in court, in the Supreme Court, that it would be legal, it would be possible for a baker to put a sign in his window saying, quote, we don't bake cakes for gay weddings. Does the president agree that that would be okay?
The president certainly supports religious liberty, and that's something that he talked about during the campaign has since upheld since taking office.
That would
I believe that would include okay. that.
Kennedy actually, in response to that, said, well, that's an affront to the gay community. Oh, really?
And how about refusing to make them the cake in the first place? Is that an affront to the gay community?
And he said that businesses could start picking customers based on identity. Yes.
Yes. So he is both offended by discrimination against us and offended by any what he perceives as an expression of discrimination against religion. Here are the possibilities. One, he could side with the conservatives and decide for the baker's right to discriminate on the basis of purported religious principles, and we would lose.
With some tortured struggle to limit the scope of the decision, they keep
good
saying.
Good luck with that.
Yes, because you're opening a Pandora's box
as
here.
As you did with Hobby Lobby.
Right.
Or he could torture himself into overlooking what he thinks is the religious discrimination in the Civil Rights Commissioner's statement and decide with the liberals, in which case we would win. Or he could decide to try to cure the Civil Rights Commissioner's statement to make himself sleep better at night, even though he has misinterpreted her statement, and remand the case to the Civil Rights Commission or to the Colorado courts for a rehearing of this case
right.
in an attempt to clarify these issues. Meanwhile, of course, this is the court that just upheld Trump's discrimination against Muslims from certain countries by upholding the travel ban.
Yeah, where's the respect for religion? Oh,
yeah.
I'm sorry, it's only Christian fundamentalism.
So we don't know where this is going to end up. It's a great mystery, and everybody is shaking their head.
And they don't have to, they don't ever have to issue the decision, but usually they save the big ones until June of 2018. again, folks, it is so important, and it doesn't it just is. Have to do with LGBT rights. It has to do with all civil rights laws. And what I would remind you is that the separation of church and state has been, pardon the expression, the salvation of the United States. It has let religion thrive, and in many forms, and it has kept us from killing each other most of the time.
Right.
But before we leave the Supreme Court, we should also mention that they denied cert. They're not going to hear Houston's challenge to the Texas High Court ruling that cast doubt on whether the city was obligated to provide equal benefits to same-sex married couples. Now, Houston, same-sex married couples are receiving equal benefits now. There is a case that's working its way through the courts. There was a bad ruling by the Texas High Court in June. It's, basically what the Supreme Court of the United States is saying, we're not ready for this. It hasn't even really been adjudicated under Obergefell by the trial court. So it's a procedural motion, essentially. It's not great. It'd be great if the Supreme Court stepped in and said, stop this nonsense. But in terms of the way they handle cases, they're not ready for it. And they have ruled in our favor in a similar case in Arkansas already.
Right, right. But we should also footnote before we leave this, something you said before we started taping. If they do remand the Masterpiece Cake Shop case back to a Colorado entity, and if we take longer to get to this Houston case, and who knows what other cases down the road, if Trump succeeds in putting another hard right conservative on the court to replace Kennedy or anybody else, we are really in trouble, because then we're just gone. They can do anything they want, right, just like the Republican Congress can do anything they want.
We will have little access to the federal court, the ultimate federal courts. The federal courts at the lower level, even with Reagan and Bush judges, has been decent to us.
Absolutely.
But we've already heard from lawyers on our side say, well, we'll do our best to stay within state law on a lot of things and just get state court rulings, because what else are we going to do?
In the final analysis, the Advocate's Matt Baum wonders whether it's fair to say that art imitates cake.
What does creative mean exactly? Nobody's really sure. Is Carvel an art gallery? Is sandwich artist a literal term? Could Subway turn people away because sandwich making is an art form? Someone could claim to be a creative accountant. These legal arguments are creative. Colleges might be creative. An apartment building, a bank, a bus. You could make the case for any kind of business. If the cake shop wins this case, it could mean that any business could say, oh no, we're creative, and we don't have to follow the law. And if that happens, queer people would be denied a lot more than cake. And by the way, this isn't the first time someone's tried this. In the 1960s, a restaurant called Piggy Park made the case that they should be allowed to turn away black customers on the basis of the owner's religious belief that black people are biblically destined for slavery. The courts rejected his reasoning then, pointing out that while the owner is entitled to his private beliefs, a business that's open to the public can't violate the public's civil rights. 50 years ago, the Supreme Court ruled in that case that segregated restaurants should be against the law. Now we're about to find out if they still believe that to be true.
It's not the first time Colorado and queer rights have met at the U.S. Supreme Court, and not the first time Justice Anthony Kennedy is the linchpin. I'm Lucia Chappell. Next time on This Way Out, we remember that May 1996 decision, when, by the way, Justice Kennedy ruled against bias. Colorado,
Colorado. For the first time in the history of the United States, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that gay and lesbian Americans are entitled to equal protection under the law.
It's important to understand that Amendment 2 was never about people. It was about conduct.
We're not trying to destroy the family. We want to have families and be accepted by our families.
Because of this ruling, there will be no logical or reasonable explanation as to why pedophilia, bestiality, bigamy, and polygamy cannot be denied to anybody that claims it.
We got a good decision, folks. It's going to have an impact for many, many years to come, and we all made it possible here in Colorado.
Sounds from our archives recall the May 1996 U.S. Supreme Court ruling on Colorado's discriminatory Amendment 2, next time on This Way Out.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. This week's program material came from Wenzel Jones and Carol Myers, produced by Steve Fried, and from Public News Service's Eric Galatas, Gay USA's Andy Hammond, Ann Northrup, and The Advocate's Matt Baum. Eileen Barton performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentham, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener donors, for making this program possible, especially during our Defeat the Noise year-end campaign at thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Richard Chappelle and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WUML Lowell, Massachusetts, KKFI Kansas City, Missouri, 3MGB Malakuta, Victoria, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
Hello, KBOO listeners. If you tuned in to listen to Preference with Alan Silver, we're experiencing some technical difficulties, so instead we'll be playing Sprouts, a weekly LGBTQ program distributed by Pacifica.
LGBTQ people don't come from LGBTQ communities, so they have to find information about who they are and what that means and what to do from other sources, which is one of the reasons why the media plays such an important role, because that's where we generally turn to find out about the world.
Welcome to Sprouts from Pacifica, radio from the grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio productions by independent community media. We bring local stories to a national audience, produced by a different local station or independent producer each week. This week, we present Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting is a listener-supported production of media for the public good in New York, online at outcastingmedia.org. Hi. I'm Steven, a youth participant in Outcasting's main studio in Westchester County, New York. On this edition of Outcasting, Outcaster Callie talks with Professor Larry Gross, a professor of communication at the Annenberg School for Communications and Journalism at the University of Southern California. As well as being a pioneer in the subject of gay and lesbian studies, Professor Gross has authored numerous books on the subject. In this interview, Professor Gross talks about how LGBTQ individuals and issues are represented in the media and why it matters.
Larry, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
The social climate for LGBTQ people is greatly affected by how the print media, news, and entertainment, film, and TV represent LGBTQ people and issues. In general, how do you think the media are doing in terms of LGBTQ representation?
They're doing much better than they did in the past. The changes in the way all of the media handle LGBTQ people and their issues are very welcome. It was a long time coming, but they are now doing much better and, on the whole, doing better than they often do with issues concerning minority groups in society.
Let's talk specifically about the news industry. A newspaper headline over an article about the Stonewall riots trumpeted, "Homo nest raided, queen bees are stinging mad," clearly anti-gay language above an article that today would be considered unacceptably homophobic. A decade later came the AIDS crisis, and it wasn't until the late 1980s that the New York Times decided it was acceptable to use the word gay. Take us briefly through the history of how LGBTQ people have been portrayed in the news touching on major events like these.
You can divide the way that the news media have dealt with LGBTQ people in decades rather conveniently. And if we begin with the public explosion of what was then called gay liberation movement after the Stonewall riots, the decade of the 70s is one in which LGBTQ people began to confront the media and demand more equitable treatment, demand to be covered in a way that was less marginalizing, less stigmatizing than had been in the past. And you quote that example from the coverage in the New York Post of the Stonewall riots, and that was fairly typical. Words like deviant, pervert were fairly standard in stories that dealt with gay people, and the stories were almost always about how they were being punished, fired, arrested, and so forth. The early successes of the gay rights movement included the decision by the American Psychiatric Association in 1973 to declassify homosexuality as a mental illness, which meant very significantly that from that point, it was possible to argue with the media that it was inappropriate to use certain stigmatizing language in reference to gay people because the official authorities, the American Psychiatric Association, had declared that they were not mentally ill. At the same time, there were efforts to change the laws in such a way that they would prohibit discrimination against gay people in housing, in employment, in public accommodations. And these legislative successes, which began to occur in the 1970s through the 80s, also began to change the way in which the media, you know, news accounts, dealt with gay issues. And the key success here was shifting the way in which the media framed gay issues from a frame of pathology and criminality to a frame of civil rights. The essential success, early success, and continuing success of the LGBTQ movement is in having the mass media, having society at large, and eventually having political leaders understand the issues as issues of civil rights and basic equality rather than as issues of marginality and of some kind of medical, legal, or moral religious stigma. Moving forward, by the middle of the 1970s, the backlash against LGBTQ people and their civil rights efforts began to be felt. The backlash was very much part of the emerging political engagement of the Christian right. By the mid-70s, gay rights became another focal point of the religious right. The success of the religious right was kind of cemented, certainly in their minds, by the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980, which they viewed as a victory for their efforts, for their point of view. So the decade of the 70s is a decade of civil rights successes, but civil rights battles, swiftly replaced in the early 1980s with the AIDS epidemic. And the historical coincidence in 1981 of the inauguration of Ronald Reagan, the news treatment of LGBTQ people became dominated by the AIDS crisis and its various aspects, including the fighting back by gay people against the drug companies and the government's lack of response. That becomes the story of the 80s. The critical aspect of the 1980s and the AIDS epidemic is that it ended the pervasive invisibility of gay people, particularly gay men, in American society, as many famous people fell out of their closets into their coffins. And there was a mass awareness of the prevalence and pervasiveness of LGBT people, particularly gay men in this case, across society. It lowered the bar for acknowledgement of the presence and ubiquity of gay people across society in a way that nothing had previously been able to do. So by the end of the 1980s, American society, as reflected and informed by the news media, was acknowledging the presence of LGBTQ people throughout American society in a way that hadn't happened before. And the big change now in the 1990s was the shift of the LGBTQ movement partially away from the AIDS crisis as pharmaceutical, as, you know, medical advances began to halt the speed of that epidemic. The shift, which kind of coincided with the beginning of the Clinton administration in 1993, a shift to a clear civil rights focus, and the early battles, the early issues of the early 1990s began to focus on the ability of LGBTQ people to enter into and participate fully in the most central institutions of American society. The military, because really the first of these battles was over the discriminatory policies of the U.S. military towards LGBTQ people, and which resulted in the Don't Ask, Don't Tell compromise, which was really a very regressive and bad solution, and which lasted, unfortunately, for a while. Then there was the fight against discrimination by the Boy Scouts, a fight that was lost because the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the Boy Scouts were a private organization and entitled to discriminate. And then, most famously and most notably, the fight over same-sex marriage, which had cropped up from time to time as early as the about 1970, 71, with the beginning of the gay rights movement, but had never really become a primary issue until 1994, when the Hawaii Supreme Court ruled that the prohibition against same-sex marriage was sex discrimination. And that set the issue up immediately as a primary focus of political debate and political contest for the next, you know, more than 10 years, until finally the resolution in the Supreme Court a few years ago.
Film and television entertainment also play a big role in how LGBT people are perceived. Tell us about how the depictions of LGBTQ people and issues in film and TV have evolved.
Well, first of all, we are a media-saturated society. The dominant pattern in the mass media in this country, in the entertainment media, has been to ignore minorities and to overwhelmingly tell stories that are really about straight white men, and to a somewhat lesser degree, straight white women. They have been the stars, the center stage performers in pretty much all of our media. As minority groups begin to edge their way onto that stage, overwhelmingly, time after time, instance after instance, whether it's African Americans or ethnic minorities going back even farther, or today, Latino or other minorities, or Asian Americans, a good example there. The minorities begin to enter the stage cast as victims and villains. They can be villains who threaten the hero and have to be countered, have to be defeated. But the pattern of minorities as a threat who need to be defeated is consistent, and also as victims. They can be victims of humor, victims of ridicule, where their presence is inherently, and their roles are inherently comic. They're kind of figures of fun whom you can laugh at, or, and this is the more progressive end of it, they can be victims who are pitied and tolerated and are sort of humanized by their suffering. And the same thing happened with gay people. When gay people begin to emerge into the mass media, they can be threatening. They can be a gay psycho killer, or very common a lesbian psycho killer, and very commonly a trans psycho killer. Trans people show up in mass media early on, usually as some kind of psychologically disturbed and threatening character. They can also be there as figures of fun. They can be sissy boys whom you laugh at. Gradually, as things begin to become liberalized, and this is what happens beginning in the 1970s with the successes of the LGBTQ movement in changing media patterns, what begins to happen is a few examples inserted into television or film content of positive counter-stereotypic examples where the point of the story is, you know, who would have thought that this person could be gay? All in the Family was the number one program on American television for several years in the early 70s, and a very important program in raising social issues that television had certainly avoided. And then the key episode of All in the Family in, I think, 1971, Archie Bunker, this comical bigot, discovers that a friend of his, who is a former NFL football player, is gay. His son-in-law tells him that, and he doesn't believe it, and he sort of confronts the football player with this as, you know, isn't that a joke that he said that? And basically the football player says he's right, and he's astounded. And this kind of pattern shows up fairly often in the 70s period of depictions, in which the message filtered through Hollywood is gay people are more prevalent than you think, and you would be surprised. They're not always the stereotypic effeminate man or masculine woman. Part of what that does is to still acknowledge or maintain the negative stigma of that stereotype, because in fact some gay men are effeminate, and you know, many lesbians are masculine in appearance, and that's not a bad thing. To some extent, the media, by saying these people are gay and you would never know it, kind of maintains the stigmatizing view of people who are in fact fitting the stereotype. But it's progress, and it's progress in a number of key ways, one of which is reaching people, particularly young people, who live in an environment in which there are no visibly gay people. And it sends the message that it is okay and possible to be gay in a way that wasn't otherwise available in the culture. And that's a key way in which these depictions begin to change social attitudes and social views. By the time we get into the 90s, there are more depictions now of gay people than there had been in the past, and they begin to have a fuller role than merely being gay. You know, who would have thought they were gay? But they're still secondary characters. They're still characters defined by their gayness as opposed to by other attributes, such as the wisecracking gay best friend who replaces the previous African-American best friend or some other marginal character. The center stage is still held by straight white characters, as pretty much is today, but you begin to get more variety, which you never see, until the advent of subscription cable channels like Showtime or HBO, is stories that are set in any kind of a gay community. Gay people are always the odd person out in a straight environment. They're always the relative you didn't know was gay, the neighbor who is gay, the one gay friend, but there never are gay communities, never are gay groups, never are gay families. And that's something that only begins to happen later in the 90s and moving into after the turn of the century. And there, I would give a lot of credit, and I think one of the key factors that was part of and ultimately responsible for changes in the media was the advent of reality television in the early 1990s. The pioneering show that launched the reality TV wave was MTV's The Real World. And The Real World has included gay members of these casts from the first year. The very first year of The Real World, which was set in New York, had a young man named Norman who was bisexual, really was gay, but introduced as bisexual. And every year of The Real World has included one or more LGBTQ characters. The third year of The Real World was the particularly important one in that the program was really built around a Cuban emigre young man named Pedro Zamora, who was HIV positive and an AIDS educator and was a very charismatic figure. And when Pedro tragically died in real life, shortly after the program had been aired, Bill Clinton called him in the hospital. It was a public event. And it was one of those milestones in raising visibility, both of LGBT people, also in this case with Pedro, a Cuban-American and somebody who died of AIDS. But the reality TV genre, which exploded very quickly in part because of the success of The Real World, and then the introduction of a series of real reality contest programs, Survivor, Big Brother, The Amazing Race, and, you know, and on and on and on. Those programs have included LGBT characters from the very beginning. these programs did a lot, particularly for the generation of people growing up with reality TV as a major part of their media diet, did a lot to make it clear to people that LGBTQ people were part of the real world, were part of the world they lived in. And to my mind, part of what made reality TV real was the unabashed acknowledgement of the presence of gay people, unlike fictional television and films, which by and large didn't do that. So reality TV, I think, played a really central role in transforming the understanding of the presence of LGBTQ people in the minds of younger people, what we now call millennials.
This is Sprouts from Pacifica, this week featuring Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting is a production of Media for the Public Good, a listener-supported independent producer based in New York, online at outcastingmedia.org. On this edition, Outcaster Callie is talking with Professor Larry Gross, a professor of communication at the Annenberg School for Communications and Journalism at the University of Southern California. He's a pioneer in the subject of gay and lesbian studies.
Professor Larry Gross, how do representations of LGBTQ people compare with representations of other minorities?
Well, all minorities share the characteristics of being marginalized. What is distinctive about LGBTQ people is that LGBTQ people don't come from LGBTQ communities. They find those communities and they build those communities, but they're not born into them. LGBTQ people are born in, you know, one might say in enemy territory. They're certainly not born into communities of people who are like them. They're born into communities of people who expect them to be standard issue heterosexuals. When people begin to realize that they're not what they are expected to be, and the same, of course, would go even more so for trans people, they don't have the support of communities that share these experiences and these challenges and, you know, these perspectives. In fact, they're usually pretty well aware that the people around them, their parents, their siblings, their friends, their teachers, would not be thrilled to find out about these differences, that they would be challenged in this way. So they have to find information about who they are and what that means and what to do from other sources, which is one of the reasons why the media plays such an important role, because that's where we generally turn to find out about the world and to find out about things. And one of the big differences between growing up as an LGBTQ person today and 10 years ago, or certainly 20 or 30 years ago today, is that now there is a lot of information available in the culture, available in the media, available in the press, and very importantly, available on the internet, none of which was true 15, 20, 30 years ago. The common experience back then was for young people to realize they were different and have a sense of, you know, I don't know whether there's anybody else like this. I thought I was the only one, to look around. And when they saw something, they typically would see something that was visible because it was so stereotypic. And therefore, the message would be that if that's what you are, then you are confined to certain stereotypes and to certain negative treatment. You will be defined in various negative ways and often treated very badly. Now, of course, this still goes on. There is bullying and there is negative treatment from families in many cases, and certainly from schoolmates and other people, but nothing like what would have happened in the past, in part because we are all much more aware now as a society of variation and difference than was the case in the past. That's the key difference between LGBTQ people and other minorities, I would say, is that as they grow up, LGBTQ people can reach out and find people like them and get solidarity and support from others. The internet now plays a very important role in that because it overcomes geographic isolation. I mean, if you grow up in a remote area and there's nobody else around like you, you have a form of isolation that can be very damaging. Today, you can reach out through the internet and find people to provide support in a way that wasn't the case before, and information and images and so forth. So that handicap has been markedly reduced in a way that's very significant. The other aspect of LGBTQ people that in a way is related to the one I mentioned is that we're everywhere. Members of the LGBTQ minority cross class lines, they cross ethnic lines, they cross gender lines, so they tend to be more diverse as a group than would be the case with other minorities. And as a result, it's not entirely clear what the phrase LGBTQ community would refer to, because the differences within that group can be quite as large as the differences between them and other people. But they still share a common sense of difference, and a difference that has consequences that they have to learn to understand and deal with.
Is it important to include LGBTQ people in the process of media production? In other words, for them to be involved behind the scenes as well as in front of the cameras?
Well, certainly, absolutely. First of all, they have been involved in media production from the beginning. The difference between people behind the camera and people in front of the camera is very important, because it has never been as difficult for people behind the camera to be openly gay, certainly not in recent years, as it is for people in front of the camera, for the actors. Right now, in Hollywood, the number of openly gay writers and directors and producers is quite large. Hollywood is a lot more worried when it comes to actors being openly gay, particularly what they call A-list actors, leading characters. Because to be a leading actor means you have to be credible, particularly for men, credible both as an action and a romantic lead. And Hollywood is still convinced, I think erroneously, but they're still convinced that the public will not readily accept an openly gay actor as a romantic slash action hero. They'll accept them as a humorous character, as a character actor, in a variety of roles, but not in the leading roles that make somebody a bankable A-list actor who can, as they say, open a movie, draw the audiences in for the big opening weekend. And particularly as Hollywood is more and more consumed with comic book-derived movies, these sort of big franchises that come out of the comic book world, they're even more worried about the possibility that a lead actor would be known to be gay. So the number of openly gay actors is much smaller than the number of openly gay writers, directors, and producers. But that's changing.
What can we do to foster and improve accurate representations of LGBTQ people in the media?
Well, one thing you can do is become an active, engaged audience member of programs and films that are positive and good. Support them, go to them. And in the age of social media, the audience gets to have a say in ways that never was true before. The age of social media, between Facebook and Twitter and all the other social media platforms, has changed the relationship between media and audiences in a fundamental way, because there is more two-way communication now. The audience speaks to itself, and they speak to the media in a way they didn't before. And the media pay attention, because everyone is aware of the power of social media. So active audiences who talk back and who both applaud